This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Can crisis tip us into an ecologically sane civilization? UK think tank report author Lori Leyburn on a future where disasters ripple across the world. Then let's get away to Antarctica. Why did sea ice crash around that frozen continent? And increasing El Nino events may drive global sea levels higher? Australian scientist Adrian Puric shares big changes at the South Pole. Welcome. This is Radio EcoShock. Two things I find most annoying in climate speak, talking about 1.5 degrees C of warming, as though that is still possible, and assuming humans will build back better no matter how many times disasters strike. A new UK think tank report tackles both. They find a looming risk of falling into, quote, a climate doom loop. The researchers come from two well-known quarters, the Institute for Public Policy Research and Chatham House, both in the UK. They question whether the grand transformation of energy and consumption, well, everything, can actually happen in a warming world. Stalling could mean we fail, becoming ruled by a continuing stream of disasters. One of the thought leaders in this process is Lori Leyburn. Lori is a visiting fellow at both think tanks, as well as the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. He appears often in European publications, TV, and radio. Lori Leyburn, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock. Well, let's start with a factoid. Loretta Heber-Girardet at the United Nations Office of Disaster Risk Reduction was presenting in a panel you moderated last June. It was part of London Climate Action Week. Loretta said by 2030, global disasters could increase by 40%. This amounts to 540 disasters every year, more than 1.5 a day. It's more than any of us can absorb or the news can report, and just 7 years away, according to the UN. Lori Leyburn, what do you think it would be like living in such a disastrous time coming right up?
It would be very distracting in an immensely tragic way. The resources of states, of communities, of companies would be increasingly absorbed by having to go into crisis management mode and respond to those types of conditions. It wouldn't be a world that has become critically fractured in the sense of there have been irreversible and catastrophic changes to the environment. Those changes are looming on the horizon, though. It's a world basically that looks like what we have seen recently, but much worse. It's a world, therefore, in which we will have to have very robust abilities and focused on not being overwhelmed by those symptoms, by those disasters, and staying focused on the root cause, on getting carbon emissions down and restoring nature.
How do you define the word disaster?
I think there are a wide range of things that we could call disasters in the context of the climate and ecological crisis. In a direct sense, we can think of the storms or heat shocks that we have seen in recent decades and that the scientific community has told us have increased markedly as a result of the climate and ecological crisis. But we also need to expand our definitions to more indirect effects. By that I mean the storms or heat extremes and so on, then leading to impacts on the food system, like a reduction in crops, which then lead to an increase in price, which then leads to the knock-on impact of affecting the ability of people to afford food and the cost of living increasing, which then can have knock-on impacts into, say, political stability, to social cohesion, to poverty, development outcomes. And it's those types of cascading impacts that we need to start to put at the forefront of our understanding of what we mean by climate shocks or climate disasters, what we mean by the consequences of this climate and ecological crisis.
Well, as I said at the beginning, many scientists and activists sniff at 1.5 degrees C of warming as an illusion, a goal in the rearview mirror. But your group found danger lurking in the idea of giving up that low goal. How so?
Well, we think the 1.5 goal has been a good motivator in many ways to date. It's provided a focus to climate action, a tangible goal, a number which I think has helped focus minds. Before, that number was ill-defined, and then was 2 degrees, which we know is even more dangerous and risky and deadly than even 1.5. As we head into the future, as we get closer to 1.5 and people begin to cast doubt on whether 1.5 is possible, we will have to seek similar motivators. At the end of the day, what we need is to deliver the huge transformations that you alluded to in your introduction, the changes to our financial systems, transport systems, and so on. And that, at the end of the day, is what we need. Ideally, it would have happened, and we would have limited to 1.1, 1.2 like we are now. Ideally, it would have happened, or it would be in train, so that we got a likelihood of limiting to 1.5. This is not 1.5. It's got to be whatever smallest increment degree to. The question is then, what kind of stories are best to motivate those transformational changes? That's what we're interested in.
The UN also said, at the same time disasters are increasing because of climate change, vulnerability is also increasing. Could you talk about that?
So, a quick definition. When we talk about the risks from the climate and ecological crisis, we think in terms of the hazards, so that those storms, waves, or the knock-on impacts like I was talking about with the food system, and then people's exposure to them and their vulnerability. Countries, for example, that rely on food imports a lot, they spend a lot, say, of their national wealth and on bringing that food into the country, they are particularly exposed and maybe vulnerable to shockwaves that filter through the food system. And ways that you can improve or reduce your vulnerability is, for example, to have a food system that might be more local, or a food system globally that's more equitable, that doesn't lead to so much wastage. It doesn't mean that those who have more wealth and power in the global economy can sometimes hoard or divert food stocks. So those are the kind of things that we could use to reduce vulnerability to some of these shocks.
Surprisingly, Loretta Heber-Girardet from the UN also warned, quote, "Where we are seeing the greatest impact is through these high-frequency, low-intensity, but very, very regular events at the community and the local level. So it's not just the big disasters that make the news that count, but repeated changes around us?"
Exactly. It's death by a million cuts is an unattractive phrase, but this is essentially what is happening, that chronic shifts in rainfall patterns, in temperature, and so on, are the types of shifting baseline that could be really deadly for crop suitability or for certain ecosystems, which lead to then less abundant animals, of insects and so on, which will then have knock-on impacts, say, for food, and more, you know, extreme persistent changes in certain weather. So basically it's that grinding change into less habitable conditions that we're beginning to see all over the world. And as you say, often media coverage of the climate and ecological crisis fixates on the big storm, the city leveling impact, whereas actually it is the day-to-day shift away from a habitable, accommodative environment that is one of the main features of how the climate and ecological crisis is making a less stable, more deadly world.
Well, I'd like to take an example from nature. Experts tell us fires are part of the forest ecology in Western North America. The trees have evolved to recover. They have strategies. But Canadian fire expert Michael Flanagan told us on radio two cases there are where forests do not return. The first is a fire so hot that the soil is sterilized. And the second is when wildfires return to the same place within 5 years, killing off young trees before they seed. Could human civilization be the same, rebuilding after one disaster but unable to continue after repeated hits?
I think one of the features of recent times, the last few decades, has been the improvement in disaster monitoring, anticipation, and then preemption. We are seeing far fewer fatalities in regions that are being impacted, say, by more extreme hurricanes or other types of storms. And that's a very welcome development. Into the future, if we do not get on top of the temperature rise globally, it does start to stretch credibility that we will be able to continue that ability to preempt the severe and deadly impacts of certain disasters and impacts. Basically, our ability to adapt or to be resilient is in some ways and definitely could be outpaced by the acceleration of escalating climate and ecological impacts. And really, we are now in the situation where we need to consider the resilience of societies in the round. We should be doing that off the back of global shocks like the COVID-19 pandemic. We definitely need that in anticipation of an era in which we'll experience far more instability, and we need to make sure that we don't get overwhelmed by that instability, because at the end of the day, we have to deal with its root causes, or else we are stuck in that vicious circle.
Extreme events not seen before can also damage people's sense of immunity. A whole generation no longer trusts their environment, their city, or their homes. They don't feel safe. Some will have post-traumatic stress disorder. Even developed countries haven't developed treatment for a whole population that gets traumatized. As we break the climate, is anyone looking into a kind of mass trauma care?
There's a established area of study and practice on so-called climate anxiety. It has other names as well. That has largely grown out of observing high, even acute levels of anxiety in children who are essentially anticipating a much harder future that they will be by the end of their long lives relative to older generations they will be disproportionately exposed to. And in general, we need to expand our understanding of resilience, or in the climate jargon, adaptation, to respect those types of emotional, psychological, mental health impacts that we are experiencing, and the world will experience more severely into the future. As with all of this, there are places that have been in an acutely destabilized state now for a very long time, those that we often describe as being on the climate front line. And they have rich lessons around, well, warnings of some of the what these impacts could look like as we head towards more of a global scale of similar destabilization and what we can do about it. But at the end of the day, governments in particular need to understand that resilience isn't just about building flood barriers or cities that can handle extreme heat. It's about ensuring societies overall are robust to being in this new climate that is being made, so that they can, as I said, not become distracted and overwhelmed by it to the detriment of dealing with its root causes.
What did your research find about cascading effects of climate-driven disasters? How do the impacts spread out over space and time?
Let's use an example that was in the news a couple of years back. The so-called heat dome that impacted North America in, I think, the summer of 2021 got a lot of coverage, at least in Western media. The main focus of that coverage was the near total destruction of Lytton, the village of Canada, which was almost completely destroyed by wildfires caused by the heat effects, extreme heat. What got less coverage was how the destruction of the local ecology of trees and other plants meant that those roots were not really holding the land in place. So when later in the winter, extreme rainfall came, probably maybe driven by the climate crisis itself, it then washed away some of that land, which damaged railways and roads, which then had a knock-on impact for Canada's trade, which was already suffering from the consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic and the impacts of that on international trade, which then would have rippled out, the effects of Canada's trade being disrupted would have rippled out into the wider trade system globally and interacted with other countries that are experiencing their own problems. That is a good example of that type of cascade dynamic, and a good example of how our attention is often on the first step of that cascade and less so on the ripple effect. And it's a ripple effect that is already deadly and will become more dangerous as we head into a climate destabilized future.
I lived through that heat dome, and we were hiding out in the basement trying to stay cool with air cleaners running to get the wildfire smoke out of the air. You told the BBC we are spending too much time mopping the floor to deal with the leak. What did you mean?
We are already having to face so many climate shocks and destabilizing impacts that are linked to the worsening climate and ecological crisis. And that may distract us, may be distracting us from reducing emissions, from pushing the changes in societies that will reduce emissions, that will restore nature. An example of this dynamic is if you look back just over a year ago to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, the weekend that that happened and he was making veiled nuclear threats, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, released one of its latest reports with some very strident warnings. And, of course, the media coverage was fixated on that invasion by Russia at the detriment of the coverage of this deeper long-term problem. Into the future, you could imagine a situation in which the world has become more conflicted, partly because of pressures on food, on water availability, on other key measures of stability. And the news coverage, the political attention, the resources will be focused on dealing with the immediate effects of that instability, on having to respond to potential instances of conflict and so on, at the cost of everyone cooperating globally to get emissions down at the pace and scale that we need to do to avoid the most catastrophic climate and ecological impacts over this century.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Laurie Leyburn from Chatham House and the Institute for Public Policy Research, the UK progressive think tank. We're talking about falling into the climate doom loop and how to avoid that. In recent years, many countries worst hit by big disasters were least able to afford to do much about them. Pakistan endured major floods, but the country's finances are on life support from the World Bank. We recently heard about extreme heat and drought hitting crops in Argentina, another nation close to bankruptcy. Will failure to recover affect the world economy and people in developed nations?
I would say in some ways that might have already happened. We are linked, all of us, by interconnected financial, economic, social, political systems. COVID was a tragic and rude proof of that. That a health emergency in one place very quickly became not just a health emergency, but also a economic and political and social emergency all over the place. Pakistan, the Pakistan government at last year's UN climate conference had a strapline that it had on one of its stalls in the exhibition space that said, "What happens in Pakistan does not stay in Pakistan." The knock-on impacts economically in the financial system, say, from the, I would say, world historic flooding that Pakistan experienced will have had some impact, in the same way that the extreme heat and drought that hit India earlier in 2022 disrupted its ability to follow through on its promises to make up for the shortfall in food production that had occurred as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which is a major part of the global food system. It's really important for us, particularly in Western countries, to understand that the climate and ecological crisis isn't something that happens over there or can be isolated over there, and by that I mean in countries across the global south. It is something that impacts us all, in the same way that the failure to provide vaccines to countries across the global south in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic increased the chance of spread and therefore mutation that could blow back on wealthy nations. The same dynamic exists with the climate and ecological crisis. We're as strong as our weakest member in a globalized, interconnected economy. If you allow certain places to fall into strife and destabilization, everyone will suffer the consequences. And the ultimate endpoint of that dynamic is that globally, we are not able to reduce emissions down to the point where we stop this spiral.
And as you say, it's not as though climate disasters arrive in an otherwise normal world. The UK recently counted another 138,000 new COVID-19 infections in a single day. The American Center for Disease Control just admitted about 1 in 5 people who had been infected with COVID have lasting effects. Millions have long COVID. I just worry that this will weaken our ability to transform anything away from the fossil-powered economy.
That's the concern, that in a world beset by multiple interrelating problems, pandemics meet climate shocks to the food system, meet record mistrust in politics, partly driven by digital technology, in that kind of swirling vortex of problems and distractions that are exacerbating each other, yeah, the concern is that that is just simply too overwhelming. But crucially, in moments of instability and flux, we can drive rapid positive change. That is something that we see persistently throughout history. And in some ways, it may have been the case that, well, it didn't have to be the case that it got this bad before stuff really started to change, but that has to be the case now. Crises cannot be let to go to waste in the sense that the old definition of crisis, that it is a turning point. And in 2007, 2008, off the back of the financial crisis that happened there, we didn't get a so-called green recovery. With COVID, it's been a bit more ambiguous. I look to the US and its Inflation Reduction Act, as well as its other big spending bits of legislation recently, as an example of how governments can rally to recognize that in the context of instability and a crisis, you can start to push the development of your economy in a better direction. A better direction in the long term because it handles the climate threat, and in the shorter term because it can insulate you against volatile energy prices and improve the quality of people's homes and so on. So the crucial thing is that it's about how we respond to those shock moments. We're not in a situation yet where they are becoming so overwhelmingly distracting and resource intensive that we just don't have any choice but to constantly respond to the last thing. We still are on the front foot. We still enjoy that agency to shift in different directions in the context of instability.
There are a number of institutions devoted to assessing risk. Some are financial institutions, and they don't publish their results. Your panel last year included a group new to me, the Global Commission on Governing Risks from Climate Overshoot. What is your assessment of the international work so far on these issues?
That the risks are conceived too much in terms of quantitative projections. I'll give you an example of this, that there's a lot of work out there that says, for example, by the year 2100, under the highest emissions trajectory, the trajectory where we just don't even really get the emissions down at all, that heat will be so extreme that there will be a loss of labor productivity in, say, human of the order of 20%. And that is spurious precision because I'm really not credible to be able to get that kind of a level of precision of how much labor productivity would be reduced in that kind of world. But it's also potentially misleading because in a world in which we've not got emissions down, labor productivity in parts of the world, all over the world, won't just be impacted directly by hotter temperatures, but indirectly through all sorts of other cascading problems like food prices and political instability and conflicts and so on. So one issue with a lot of this work is it needs to focus much more on a mix of modelling and quantitative measures with more storytelling and qualitative assessments, kind of pictures of what that work would look like, scenario planning, for example. And secondly, when we consider a world in which we may go above 1.5 degrees, we have to understand that it's not just a case of pulling some technological levers, of one lever that sucks down carbon from the atmosphere here and another one that might reflect some of the sun's rays back into space, so-called geoengineering. Both of those things are risky and in many ways unproven, definitely the scale that we would need. Instead, we have to focus on the things that we should always have been doing, which is reducing emissions through demand management, so wasting far less improving insulation and so on, the kind of measures that will also help us create a more secure society. And by making sure that we are ensuring societies are more resilient. And those things are complementary. A society with better insulated homes, with more local involvement in, say, the food system and so on, will be ones that are lower carbon and ones that are more resilient.
Laurie, are well-known environment groups taking in your message? Can civil activism help us?
Yes, I think that in some ways, activism, particularly direct action activism, has actually internalized these types of messages. In fact, I've personally learned a lot from the messages that they have been using over the last few years. Let's take Extinction Rebellion, which had a huge impact, not just in the UK, but globally, with its occupation of London in April 2019. Its message of tell the truth is a useful one, because that has to be an element of the resilience of societies going forward. A story that I sometimes use in the context of the UK is that the government, politicians, people like Churchill in the context of the Second World War, they didn't completely sugarcoat the situation that the country was facing. There were things that were covered up or reframed, of course, but there was still a clear statement that it was an existential threat to the country in the Second World War. And what that enabled was a connection between society, its lived experience, and what needed to be done, so that then that could be done. And it helped form part of a story that gave the country resilience as it had to go through that incredibly trying existential battle. And the focus of much of activism recently on that truth, for me, is an important part of how we build the type of resolve and resilience of that resolve into the future.
Your new paper with Henry Thropp and Susanna Sherman of Chatham House is titled 1.5 Degrees, Dead or Alive. What led to this report, and is more follow-up planned?
We did the report because we wanted to explore this doom loop dynamic, to make this warning that societies could be so bound up by handling the symptoms of the climate and ecological crisis that they are derailed from dealing with the root causes, and that creates that vicious circle. And we wanted to use the example of the growing rejection of the possibilities for 1.5 as an example of that difficult dynamic, that as in that case, as we're heading nearer to 1.5, you have got people who are saying, well, it's dead now. Now, the scientists say it's still physically possible, but what's missing is the political will. I would slightly change the language and say, saying 1.5 is dead is basically passing your own judgment on the possibilities for the vast transformations that we need. And it's fair enough, I think, if some people have said, It seems to me that those transformations are possible, if not just because of understandable cynicism at the state of politics and so on. But in a world in which we, say, ditch 1.5 and don't have an alternative story that motivates that transformation, the kind of transformation that could still give us a chance at 1.5, then you're in trouble. Because then you're in a world in which we're not motivated to deliver massive change to our societies. More instability comes, which could further demotivate and so on. So we wanted to do the report to kind of use the debate over 1.5 as a case study to highlight that wider dynamic. And it is part of a wider project called Cohort 2040, which is looking at how we can support younger generations, mainly those in the millennial generation, to anticipate and be better able to navigate a rapid, equitable transformation of societies through the unstable conditions that we're already seeing and will increasingly see in the future, to make sure that that generation, as it passes into senior leadership in the coming years and decades, can break that doom loop and instead have a virtuous circle where moments of instability are galvanizing, where they are moments to drive more rapid and positive change.
That seems like a good place to wrap up. We've been speaking with UK researcher, author, and strategist Laurie Leyburn. Find his new report, 1.5 Degrees C, Dead or Alive, at www.ippr.org. I will put links up in my discussion on the show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Laurie, it was great to talk with you. Thank you.
Alex, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This